Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, July 19th, 2021, the 200th day of the year. And as always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever discovered or encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the link that says Start Here in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and turn any negative emotional state into part of that infallible guidance system that we've all been gifted. You can also click on the PDF file and download the actual worksheet process absolutely free. You can also play a whole host or download and then listen to a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through the worksheet process or asked clarifying questions about the process or the underlying dynamics. Or perhaps they've called in to give powerful testimonials about how the actual application of that tool in their lives is providing great benefit. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you finish typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. And you click on that, it'll give you access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope you do that soon and often because primarily it has the potential to improve your life dramatically. And secondarily, it often promotes questions and comments or testimonials. And if you have any of those, give us a call at 563-999-3581. Alternatively, you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org, or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. We're also doing the Course in Miracles lessons from the workbook this year. This is the 200th day of the year. I want to back up to Saturday and Sunday because Saturday's lesson reads, Only my condemnation injures me. And then the commentary tells you that in truth, injury is impossible. And yet illusion makes illusion. If you can condemn, you can be injured. This is an expansion on the old adage, judge not lest ye be judged, which some people interpret as if you judge somebody else, God is going to judge you. And other people interpret it as only in the judging do you create a world where offense is possible. And that's what this lesson is pointing to. Yesterday's lesson was, I am not a body, I am free. And today's lesson is, there is no peace except the peace of the Creator. And so if you keep seeking, you won't find anything. If you don't seek, if you just tap into your true nature, you will have the peace of the Creator. Accept this fact and save yourself the agony of yet more bitter disappointments, bleak despair, and a sense of icy hopelessness and doubt. So, the final point to which each of us must come at last is to lay aside all hope of finding happiness where there is none, and of being saved by what can only hurt, of making peace out of chaos, of trying to turn joy into pain, and making heaven out of hell. Attempt no more to win through losing, nor to die to live. But you cannot but be asking for defeat. So, again, there are 11 paragraphs of commentary, but the essence is, seek no further. You've come to where the road is carpeted with leaves of false desires, fallen from trees of hopelessness that you sought before. So, peace cannot be found among them. The peace of God, the peace of creation, the peace of love is yours. And only this is what we will accept and want with today's lesson. So Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment talks about today, this lesson 200 is titled, Be Weird, Have Fun, Start Now. She quotes Maurice Sendak as saying, I am in love with the world. Pam writes, in Europe, soccer, they call it football, is huge, really big. The best players make $50 million per year. Östersund's FK, a football club in remote northern Sweden, in a town just 240 miles from the Arctic Circle, knew that their only hope of competing in the big leagues was Elgest. It's a Swedish term that means be different. Their coach, Graham Potter, a Brit who had never really led a team before, noticed that all teams trained the same. They organized the same and they played the same. They were mostly owned by old white dudes. What if he mixed it up? What if, in addition to practices, he started a culture academy where his players were encouraged to try something new, to step out of their comfort zones? What if he got the whole town involved? So, in 2010, his first year as coach of this team that was lucky to get 600 fans to a game, he required his players to perform Swan Lake for the community. The next year, they wrote a book. They went on to paint, to stage a rock concert, to mentor a team of refugees in Darfur. And a funny thing happened. This little team of soccer rejects went from fourth-tier soccer when, quote, the Be Weird experiment, close quotes, began in 2010, to playing first-tier soccer. In 2017, they won the Swedish Cup. They've gone on to play in the Europa League and have racked up wins against such powerhouses as Berlin and Galatasaray SK, a legendary Turkish team. So impressed by their grit, they gave them a standing ovation. As their manager said, win every game, even if the score shows otherwise, because we learn something new every time. That quote is, we win every game, even if the score shows otherwise, because we learn something new every time. So today, as we ponder lesson 200, think of the Östersund's FK, who accomplish the impossible by changing their mindset, being brave, and opening up to a whole new weird way of being. So instead of searching for the peace, instead of searching outside of yourself, what if it's already there inside of you? There is no peace except the peace of the Creator, and that lies within me. So that's our Course in Miracles lesson for today, and we have 48 minutes to talk, answer comments or questions, or discuss a topic of your choosing. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, I'll see a little question mark by your phone number, and we will have a conversation. How can we support you today? What's on your mind? Today's a Monday, so tomorrow night we'll have another support group, a Mind Shifter support group from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central. And again on Thursday night from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central. All the information for joining that is available at mindshiftersacademy.org. There is a separate page for information for the Tuesday and Thursday groups. Later today, we'll have a pre-recorded hour for our second hour today, and again for second hour tomorrow as Michael and Jeannie are traveling. And it'll be a talk about getting the stress you need and so getting the stress you need might sound like a strange topic, but Michael explains that we don't do anything as human beings unless we have stress, because the stress is this tension that's created within us between the difference between two images. One is the image of the way we see things, the way we think things are, and the other image is the way we want them to be. So for today and tomorrow, there'll be a Getting the Stress You Need lecture for our second hour. And we're here in the first hour and live and ready to take your comments or questions. 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, we'll have a conversation. What's on your mind today? How can we support you? I wrote a blog post yesterday about the book, The Zyprexa Papers, which I had listened to over Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And The Zyprexa Papers is a compelling story of how one attorney basically risked everything, his career, his finances, his reputation, to get information out to the public, the accurate information about the dangers of a drug and about the drug companies and the court system's obstacles to alerting the public about things that are in the public's best interest. So I would say I highly recommend the book, except I understand that most people wouldn't be interested in a book like this because it's lots and lots of reading court transcripts and following this, what to me was a very compelling story about Jim Gottstein, who is an attorney in Alaska who has dedicated himself to helping he's created a website or a not-for-profit called Psych Rights, P-S-Y-C-H Rights, R-I-G-H-T-S. It's a law project for psychiatric rights, and he advocates for people who are being forced into confinement and forced to take medications against their will. And he's done this book called The Zyprexa Papers, where he details his efforts to blow the whistle on a major drug company that was hiding the fact that they knew this medication made people very sick and even caused death in many cases. So in the course of writing that blog post, I was informed by somebody who read it that they want to introduce me to several other people who have had their own mental health adventures or crises and recovered and become quite powerful and successful in the world. Karis Myrick was the CEO of a large Los Angeles mental health corporation. She was also the president of the board of the NAMI, National Association of Mental Health Initiatives, whatever. And she's also been a director of the National SAMHSA Office of Consumer Affairs. And so there's also Katera Aslami, who is an immigrant escapee from Afghanistan who grew up in the U.S., and she was being bullied. She fought back. She's highly successful and very visible senior management executive position in the Alameda County in Oakland. She's a leader, expert, navigator, spokesperson, ambitious and successful advocate for mental health services. So now all of a sudden, I'm having people come out of the woodwork who are advocates for mental health services. And it's delightful to learn more and more about people all over the place who are speaking up about injustice in the system and trying to help people develop access points for more respectful, productive, and holistic or whole person approaches to mental health situations. So our calling number is 563-999-3581. What would you like to talk about? You can get access to the Zyprexa papers through Amazon. You can also get access to, there are several books that are mentioned. One of them is Robert Whitaker's book, which I read a couple of years ago, about the Anatomy of an Epidemic is the title, and it's about how every single medication for psychiatry that Robert Whitaker has ever learned of is intended for short-term temporary use. And yet that's not the way they're prescribed, or that's not the real life experience. Because the reason that they're set up for, the reason, if it might be okay to read my blog. Yes, it might be okay. I'll read my blog. That was the noise we just heard. I might as well just go ahead and do that since I lost my train of thought. There are books that are mentioned, including Robert Whitaker's book about Anatomy of an Epidemic, and there are books about what the drug companies are doing and what we can do about it, how we can learn the truth of what they're doing and what we can do about it. And there are books about recommended in the Zyprexa papers about people who have been through the system and recovered and have good messages. So the blog entry I wrote was titled Advocating for Effective and Humane Psychiatric Care. Dear friends, as you know if you read this blog, I have been donating my time to interview guests for the On Your Mind podcast hosted by Journey's Dream. The list of interviewees is available at journeystream.org/podcast. Many of the guests have been professionals who help those experiencing mental health challenges. And some of those professionals have experienced their own mental health challenges. Recently, I interviewed someone who suggested the book Zyprexa Papers by Jim Gottstein. I instantly ordered it and listened to it on Audible. While I know that most people won't take the time to read a book like this, I found it compelling on many levels and want to share some of the key points I gleaned from the book. The first huge takeaway is that the drug companies are much more focused on profits than they are on helping us as consumers. The next big takeaway is that the court system is based on precedent, not on logic, not on truth, not on the pursuit of what is good and best for the individuals who find themselves embroiled in that system. The court system is much more concerned with maintaining its system than it is with protecting truth, morality, or justice. I'm listing here four other books suggested by the author of Zyprexa Papers, which have just moved to the top of my reading list. If you know someone who is struggling with mental health challenges, please let them know of the resources at journeysdream.org or samehereglobal.org. Same here, all one word, samehereglobal.org. In most cases, there are numerous good alternatives to a lifetime of psychotropic medications. While there is a role for psychotropic medication, every medication I have ever learned about is designed for short-term usage and has increasing negative consequences the longer it is used. The Zyprexa Papers by Jim Gottstein. This is the write-up that is in Amazon. On December 17, 2006, the New York Times began a series of front-page stories about documents obtained from Alaska lawyer Jim Gottstein, showing Eli Lilly had concealed that its top-selling drug caused diabetes and other life-shortening metabolic problems. The Zyprexa Papers, as they came to be known, also showed Eli Lilly was illegally promoting the use of Zyprexa on children and the elderly, with particularly lethal effects. Although Mr. Gottstein believes he obtained the Zyprexa Papers legally, the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn decided he had conspired to steal the documents, and Eli Lilly threatened Mr. Gottstein with criminal contempt charges. In the Zyprexa Papers, Mr. Gottstein gives a riveting firsthand account of what really happened. New details about how a small group of psychiatric survivors spread the Zyprexa Papers on the internet in an untraceable way, and all of this within a gripping, plain language explanation of complex legal maneuvering and his battles on behalf of Bill Bigley, a psychiatric patient whose original ordeal made possible the exposure of the Zyprexa Papers. Again, that's just reading from the summary on Amazon. Another book is The Fight to Be, subtitled A Psychologist's Experience from Both Sides of the Locked Door. Once a 22-year-old man, stripped naked, shackled in restraints, and subjected to mind-numbing drugs and 40 life-threatening insulin comas, all in the name of treatment, Dr. Ronald Bassman painfully and slowly reconstructed his shattered life. Today, as a teacher, therapist, and activist, and an internationally sought-after speaker, Dr. Bassman takes us inside his extraordinary journey of recovery, challenges the medical community's reliance on pharmaceutical solutions as the only path to healing, and explodes the myths of diagnostic certainties and limitations. Drawing on his and others' firsthand stories, he explores new, compassionate paradigms of transformation and recovery. Riveting, horrifying, and ultimately uplifting, A Fight to Be is a story of courage, determination, resilience of the human spirit, and above all, hope and possibility. Dr. Bassman's unique insight from both sides of the locked door challenges readers to open their minds and their hearts, re-examine assumptions, discard limitations, and embrace possibilities. It's a groundbreaking book A Fight to Be speaks directly to individuals, families, students, professors, and clinicians with a compelling message. We can and must do better. The next book is The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It. The summary on Amazon reads, during her 2 decades at the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Marcia Engel had a front row seat on the appalling spectacle of the pharmaceutical industry. She watched drug companies stray from their original mission of discovering and manufacturing useful drugs and instead become vast marketing machines with unprecedented control over their own fortunes. She saw them gain nearly limitless influence over medical research, education, and how doctors do their jobs. She sympathized as the American public, particularly the elderly, struggled and increasingly failed to meet the spiraling prescription drug prices. Now in this bold, hard-hitting new book, Dr. Engel exposes the shocking truth of what the pharmaceutical industry has become and argues for essential, long-overdue change. Currently, Americans spend a staggering $200 billion each year on prescription drugs. As Dr. Engel powerfully demonstrates, claims that high drug prices are necessary to fund research and development are unfounded. The truth is that drug companies funnel the bulk of their resources into the marketing of products that have dubious benefit. Meanwhile, as profits soar, the companies brazenly use their wealth and power to push their agenda through Congress, the FDA, and academic medical centers. Zeroing in on hugely successful drugs like AZT, which was the first drug to treat HIV/AIDS, called Taxol, the best-selling cancer drug in history, and the blockbuster allergy drug Claritin, Dr. Engel demonstrates exactly how new products are brought to market, and drug companies, she shows, routinely rely on publicly funded institutions for their basic research. They rig clinical trials to make their products look better than they are, and they use their legions of lawyers to stretch out government-granted exclusive marketing rights for years. They also flood the market with copycat drugs that cost a lot more than the drugs they mimic, but are no more effective. The American pharmaceutical industry needs to be saved, mainly from itself. And Dr. Engel proposes a program of vital reforms, which includes restoring impartiality to the clinical research and severing the ties between drug companies and medical education. Written with fierce passion and substantiated with in-depth research, The Truth About the Drug Companies is a searing indictment of an industry that has spun out of control. I have also read and been enlightened by the book Anatomy of an Epidemic, subtitled Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. Again, the Amazon summary reads, in this astonishing and startling book, award-winning science and history writer Robert Whitaker investigates a medical mystery. Why has the number of disabled mentally ill in the United States tripled over the past 2 decades? Every day, 1,100 adults and children are added to the government disability rolls because they have become newly disabled by mental illness. With this epidemic spreading most rapidly among our nation's children, what is going on? Anatomy of an Epidemic challenges listeners to think through that question themselves. First, Mr. Whitaker investigates what is known today about the biological causes of mental disorders. Do psychiatric medications fix chemical imbalances in the brain, or do they in fact create them? Researchers spent decades studying that question, and by the late 1980s, they had their answer. Listeners will be startled, no, really dismayed, to discover what was reported in the scientific journals. Then comes the scientific query at the heart of this book. During the past 50 years, when investigators looked at how psychiatric drugs affected long-term outcomes, what did they find? Did they discover that the drugs help people stay well and function better, enjoy good physical health? Or did they find that these medications, for some paradoxical reason, increase the likelihood that people will become chronically ill, less able to function well, and more prone to physical illness? This is the first book to look at the merits of psychiatric medications through the prism of long-term results. By the end of this review comes literature. Listeners are certain to have a haunting question of their own. Why have the results from these long-term studies, all of which point to the same startling conclusion, why have they been kept from the public? That's the end of my blog. I end it with thanks for reading. Remember, we come from love. We're made of love. We are love, and everything else is false. So, as requested, I read the blog. We have 28 minutes left to discuss that or anything else. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks for reading that, Dr. Tim. That is scary.
Oh, no. My favorite. But it might be a cause for you to pick up your favorite misery tool.
Miserable. Right. Well, I have a question from it. You're right. Since I have a husband and a son both on, and a grandson, in fact, two or three grandsons on medications, it hits really close to home. At one point, Tim was on Zyprexa, but is no longer for some reason. I didn't ever follow the reasons. But my question is, do you think that this misbehavior on the part of the drug companies, greed and so forth, is one of the reasons people are refusing to be vaccinated?
Oh, yeah.
And is there any connection between, because everything I read, and I have a, my daughter's fiance is a doctor, and I have a good friend who's an immunologist and a virologist, and they're all saying that this is the most harmless set of little ingredients that just jumpstart the immune system to recognize the danger of the COVID virus before it can do any harm, because it's being delivered into the body in an innocuous, safe way so that the body will recognize the real enemy should it show up. And it seems by all reports to have been very successful, even against the Delta variant, which seems to be, my daughter was talking to me this morning, she said there's a real uptick of COVID cases, but it's, whether Delta or not, I don't know, but she said it's all with the unvaccinated. Now here it looks as if you have a good thing. And the polio vaccine, look what it did, or the smallpox vaccine, look what it did. And so it's just, how can we get the truth? And I'm just disturbed to hear this. It's like the pharmaceutical industry has shot itself in the foot and hurt a lot of people too.
Yep. And almost every industry that gets big and powerful goes through a phase of doing that to varying degrees. Mm. And the bigger they are, the more investors get involved, and then the investors drive the agenda, and no matter how well-intentioned the original players were, it turns into something else. But the real point here is that you got disturbance and anxiety up in you. So, you know,
well,
none of that...
wait a minute. No.
None of that is needed. Let me backtrack.
No.
None of that is needed to address the issue.
And that isn't my question. Question is, I put my question in an academic way, just as you think. It's true. I mean, this is alarming. I wouldn't say I had a panic attack over it or even an anxiety attack over it. I'm just, maybe I shouldn't have used that word, that it's scary. It's dismaying. It's disturbing. Maybe that's also not fair to say on a program where everything originates from inside of us. But you wrote that blog, and it raises concerns.
Well, it doesn't have to raise concerns. It can raise awareness. And so if you're educated about alternatives, and that's the big thrust of this, is go to the On Your Mind podcast or go to Same Here Global, and you'll start to see resources for differing ways to deal with mental health challenges than just medication.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
that's true.
So
and
why would somebody do that when the medication is so much easier and quicker? Well, the reasons need to be explored. Why would you do that when somebody's offering you a pill? Well, maybe the pill isn't so safe. Maybe the pill has unintended consequences. Maybe the pill only covers up a problem rather than helping you deal with it at the cause level. And so the blog and the podcast are just there to raise awareness and hopefully point people towards more effective and humane resources for dealing with mental health challenges.
I agree with all of that. You're talking about healing versus treatment, and the pill is a treatment, but it's not a healing. That's true. But in the case of vaccines, we're not talking about a treatment. We're talking about a preventative, something that appears to be organic. It's made out of organic materials, according to my daughter's fiancé. It's made out of natural organic materials that come from nature that are just arranged in such a way as when they're injected in the body, wake up the immune system. It sounds like such a wonderful thing, and yet a lot of people are missing out from using it because of their distrust about medications in general.
Well, and the other factor is the politicization, people making everything so political. And so,
right.
You know, we have people who are convinced that big, bad, evil players are running the world. Well, and to some degree, if they're only focused on money at the expense of the welfare of the public, you could say that about the drug companies. But if you extend that into politics and you extend that into people who believe that it's an actual battle for the soul of the world, that we've got, you know, angels and demons and aliens and others fighting for control of our world, then it's a whole different story. And I don't have anything to say about all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where a lot of the people saying, I don't want a vaccination, comes from. It's either political or it's a theory about how this is a whole depopulation plan, that they're actually poisoning you with, you know, with the injection rather than healing you or saving you or protecting you in any way.
That's true. Also, we have become aware of ways of staying well by taking care of our mental health, by having a positive attitude, by taking precautions or whatever it is. So, and also we're aware of, I have a good friend who's a functional medical doctor. She's an MD and then went on to become a functional medical doctor. And she had a terrible case of Lyme disease and found her way toward health coming through alternative medical means. And I'm pretty sure she's not taking the vaccine because she understands her own system and relies on her own I don't know what it all is, but she is wary of taking the vaccine because it's like, maybe it's like a sledgehammer where all you need is a tiny little tap. Or I'm not sure. I'd be interested to talk to her, and I should have before I brought her up. There are politicized people who are political, people who are mistrustful and think, you know, Big Pharma is out to get them and they're just not going to do it at all. But there's a whole other bunch of people who believe they can keep themselves safe with the right spiritual attitude. I'm not sure I understand it all, and I certainly admire that if they feel confident and they remain well, and I hope they do. But then again, there's some, even in there, there's a level of mistrusting the substance, or maybe even the motives of people who are producing these vaccines. And so it goes into the political realm where it maybe even doesn't belong there. I don't even know how to talk about that part of it, but most of the people I know and admire greatly who don't take the vaccine are not avoiding it because it's part of some huge conspiracy theory or because Donald Trump didn't think the vaccine was necessary or that COVID even existed or whatever it was. That's not how they feel. They feel that they're, I guess I could say they feel as if they're relying on a higher power to keep them well. And if they do that, that's way beyond my capacity. I took the vaccine, but I admire that. If they're really sure, and if they don't get sick, they'll remain sure. If they do get sick, I don't know what they'll do with their thoughts. But anyway, that's not anything I can mess around with at all or understand either.
Okay, okay. So why are we talking about it then? Where are we going?
I don't know where we're going.
Okay.
I don't
well,
know.
So-
yeah.
So the point of the blog is to raise awareness and give people options.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're educated, I remember when Dale Allen Hoffman came to town, he said, you know, if you go to a Christian bookstore and you start asking them for books on Islam or Hinduism
yeah.
or Buddhism, you are not going to get the truth. You're going to get
mm-hmm.
a slice of it. You're going to get some little bits of it. But so if you go to drug companies to find out about drugs, you're not going to get the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and these days it's also very, because of the, as one of those little blurbs that I just read talked about, because of the entanglement between the drug companies, Big Pharma, and medical education, it isn't even a real good idea to rely completely on what your doctor tells you. It's
right.
a good idea to rely on it if your doctor is a functional medicine trained person or an integrative medical physician, because he or she will have training in both sides, and they will have gone outside the box of the traditional medical education. They will have done the traditional medical education and then added to it, like Dr. Jody Skillicorn
yeah.
that I interviewed for the On Your Mind podcast. She became a psychiatrist, a regular psychiatrist, and she did her internship and her residency, and she got out. And then somebody introduced her to Robert Whittaker's book, and she was just shocked at what was available. She didn't know to look for it when she was in medical school, but these are things that
yeah.
have been published in actual medical journals, actual research
mm-hmm.
on the long-term effects of these medications. Well, she didn't get any of that in her medical school training. And it was so diametrically opposed, you know, what she learned, the truth about those medications, was so diametrically opposed to what she'd been taught in medical school that she immediately changed everything she was doing with her patients and re-educated herself about more actual healing approaches and holistic or functional medicine or integrative medicine approaches. So it's adding to the knowledge from our medical training. And it is, you know, the hope of me writing a blog like that or promoting these interviews on the On Your Mind podcast with Journey's Dream is to raise awareness and give people options that they don't have if they don't have the basic information.
That's good.
And now, all these years later, I realize why I had such a rough time in graduate school when my thesis, my doctoral dissertation, was on how I had observed how few people that were getting their doctorate and getting a license, passing the licensing exam, how few of them actually understood statistics and research design, even the most basic statistics and research design, which, of course, is the tool they're supposed to have to evaluate the articles they read to decide whether or not it's a scam article or it's got useful information.
Dr. Kim, there's a sudden static. You're speaking, you're going in and out. I don't know whether other people, if somebody listening could text in and say whether it's just my phone, it's getting harder to hear you.
Okay, well, I don't know what to do about that unless I can hang up and call back in, because I'm sitting here in my office, as I almost always do, and I haven't changed position or taken a hike.
Okay, I'm going to hang up and dial in and see if it's my end. That's easy enough to do.
All right.
So I'm hanging.
Wait, Susan. Well, I guess I missed her. But I had somebody else who said it's hard to hear all of a sudden. So I'll do the same thing. I'll be right back.
Oh, good. Okay, I was just texting you that there was no sound at all. So,
well, that's because
I also
got a text message from Mary that said it was very difficult to hear. So I hung up and called back myself.
Oh, good. Well, it seems fine now. So good. Good. Well, thanks for that, Dr. Kim. I feel as if the vaccination end of things has taken a terrible hit because of what Big Pharma has been doing. So the possible help that vaccine could be as great as the smallpox or polio one, or even the flu shots that we've been getting every year, many of us anyway. It seems as if it's being distrusted in a way, and maybe it should be. I mean, I'm not sure. It just sounds so good.
Well, there's all kinds of debate about it, and I have to leave that up to the experts, because I am not an immunologist, and I am not a psychiatrist. I am not a medical doctor, and that's why when somebody says to me, you know, there's a serious problem and we have experts, we have published studies, we have court cases, you know, one of the points of the court case, if you can imagine this, with all their money, Eli Lilly paid over $1.4 billion and pled guilty with all their money and attorneys. So there was something way, way out of whack.
Yeah.
And so when I find out something like that, I want to educate myself because, you know, I've been in the field for years and I've been getting fed the same thing by psychiatrists who are educated by the drug companies. And they said, hey, you know what? This medication and this medication for anxiety, they aren't addictive the way Valium is. Well, you wait 5 years and you find out, oops, we lied. They're very addictive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we are all limited in what we know. And whenever there's an opportunity for me to expand my knowledge base in a reputable way, I try to take advantage of it. And that's what the latest blog post is about. And that's what the On Your Mind podcast is about, is to get various experts, whether they're experts in the field of psychiatry or psychology, integrative or functional medicine, whether they're experts because they've been through it themselves and they've recovered and found a new way or a different way other than just taking a pill to get through a mental health challenge and have it be transformational in a good way in their life, then I want to learn about that.
Yeah. Good.
And this is, you know, essentially we come right back to the beginning of why are we even here talking? Because the tools that Dr. Michael Rice makes available, and Michael and Jeannie have made available for years now, when I first got introduced to them, it was like coming home. It was like the best of the best stuff I'd done for 30 years in therapy, trying to teach people. And it had this very succinct worksheet process and, you know, on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And it had the connection to the ancient Aramaic, which, you know, tapped into all kinds of other wisdom from thousands of years before that. So I was already focusing with patients, clients, friends, and family for decades before I encountered Michael Rice's stuff about how I'm creating my emotions inside of me. And if I don't like that experience, if I discover how I'm creating that emotional response, I can use it as valuable information to do a course correction. A course correction in my life. And that is at the root of some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my 47 years of doing therapy, and they're available at whyagain.org. That's why we're here. And there's nothing in this work that says don't take a medication, but there is a lot in this work that says don't just take a medication because that's not going to fix anything. Do the work. Find out, whether it's through Michael's tools or someone else's, find out how to correct your own internal process.
So good.
So that's what we're here about. And we're hopeful that this is useful because that's the whole point, is to be of service. And hopefully I'm going to have another interview tomorrow with a gentleman who's working with sound, binaural sound and light in working with treating people with trauma and other executive function disorders. And so there'll be more interviews coming out on Journey's Dream.
What's the man's name?
The man for tomorrow is Dr. Lindenfeld.
Okay, I haven't heard of him, but...
Yeah, well, most people haven't, but he is associated with the BAUD, the Bioacoustical Utilization Device. And he's also been doing a lot of work with the V-light, light therapy that, you know, most people have heard about the benefits of somebody who's got a seasonal affective disorder.
Oh, yeah.
During the darker seasons where there isn't as much sunlight or people can't get out as much, they tend to get more depressed on cloudy days. If people have it to a moderate to severe level, even one day where the sun doesn't come out, it affects their mood negatively. And so if you sit in front of a full spectrum light and let it hit your face and your body, you get benefit. The full spectrum light, like the light of the sun, stimulates production of vitamins like vitamin D and hormones and neurotransmitters that are good for mood and the pleasure centers, et cetera. Well, the V light takes that research to the next level and is using near-infrared light and putting it into head units and intranasal units to give people a more direct experience of the light, which particular frequencies of light, near-infrared light, that can stimulate positive changes in the brain. So
wow.
I'll be interviewing him tomorrow.
Great.
And also tomorrow, the episode that's scheduled to be released is an interview with Dr. Gail Brenner, who wrote the book The End of Self-Help.
Oh, yeah. Good,
so,
juicy stuff.
So we will continue to ask people to send us suggestions about books we could read or people we could interview, and we will continue to provide that service. It's absolutely free, journeysdream.org/podcast. So we're down to our last couple of minutes. I will thank you again, Susan, for the call and mute you and get ready for the transition. The second hour today will be Getting the Stress You Need, Part 1. And tomorrow will be Part 2 while Michael and Jeannie are traveling. So thanks again, Susan.
Welcome.
Blessings.
Thank you.
And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And here's our second hour today, pre-recorded.
Welcome to the workshop, Getting the Stress You Need. Tonight we're going to take a little different look at stress and its impact on our lives than the way the culture usually looks at stress. And we're going to start to identify how stress is created and the role that it plays in our lives and how absolutely necessary stress is. Because without stress, there wouldn't be life. If you didn't have the stress of thirst, you wouldn't drink. And without that signal and not drinking, you'd die with the lack of water. If you didn't have the stress that comes from the feelings of sitting on the tack, you wouldn't get off of the tack. So those stressors are necessary. And we find that there are two different qualities of stress, one of them constructive and one of them destructive. And we want to look at exactly how those stresses are created, exactly how the mind produces stress, so that we can take charge of that process. A lot of times our culture is set up in a way that creates stress in us, or at least that triggers stress in us. We're trained into those stresses, and we find ourselves thinking things that we'd rather not think, saying things we'd rather not say, doing things that we'd rather not have done, and not realizing why that is. And I'd offer that the reason why we say what we say, why we do what we do, is because we have stressors that promote and create those behaviors. What you'll find ultimately is that the human mind is a stress management device. The human mind, you know, there are theories that say the human mind, you know, does what it does to protect its ego and do all sorts of things. And in reality, what it does is it very, very well manages stress. And we'll see that there are different states of mind that you can come from in managing your stress. There are two states of mind in which, in attempting to manage stress, you will find that you continuously increase your stress. Your behaviors will produce more stress. And then there's a frame of mind, a state of mind, in which your mind can accurately guide you to reduce your stresses. And we'll look into some ancient teachings and how they referred to that process of managing your stress. Has anybody here got someone in your life that if they would just be different, if they just change, everything in your life would be wonderful? Anybody have someone like that? Okay, so we've got lots of yays on that one. Well, have you ever, in trying to avoid that person, has anybody ever taken the geographic cure where you go to the other side of the country where people will be different, and then the person that picks you up at the airport finishes the sentence that the person that dropped you off started, and there's your stressor again? What's the game? What's happening here? Well, as you understand how this mind is managed, and we're going to come from some ancient teachings in looking at this process of producing stress and reducing stress and managing the mind and what are the laws that govern that process. I'm going to ask you if you'd allow yourself, if you're at home watching this video or if you're in the audience here, I'm going to ask you for a moment if you just kind of get quiet. Go inside of yourself. And in getting into that quiet space, I'm going to invite you to go through a series of feelings. So if you would just kind of close your eyes, go inside. And I'm going to ask you first to allow yourself to feel sadness. Would everyone do that? Let yourself feel sadness. Notice as you feel sadness, what happens to your breath. And then I'm going to ask you to shift from sadness to fear. Let yourself for a moment feel fear. And then I'm going to ask you to shift once more and allow yourself to feel anger. And then once more, I'm going to ask you to shift into feeling intimidated. Notice where your breath is and what's happening with your breath. And then just open your eyes and come on back to our workshop. Does anybody feel more stressed now than you did 5 minutes ago? Is anybody experiencing any more stress? Hands going up, head shaking. Okay, great. All right. So how was that stress created? What did you do to feel each feeling that you just felt? Anyone? What did you do?
Created some pictures of each situation.
Okay, so you created some pictures of situations. What did you use? I'm going to invite you to identify what you used to create those pictures. What did you use?
Used my memory.
Used your memory. Okay. But there was something in your memory that you used specifically. What was it? Do you have an insight into that?
Something that bothered you.
Okay. But to get to what bothered you, what did you do?
Imagination.
Okay. You imagined. How did you access what was in your imagination?
Feeling.
Okay. You felt it, but what did you do to get to the feeling? You had a thought. You had to think about it. You had a thought. Now notice the impact of thoughts on your physiology. Now, we just did this little 2-minute experiment. You had a series of feelings. Whose feelings were you feeling?
My own.
Your own, okay? First thing established. Whose thoughts caused those feelings? Your thoughts caused your feelings. Now, think about that person that if they just change, everything would be different. And kind of key into the situations you just went to and the feelings that you have and the stress that you feel. And how many find that the feelings that you have match, in just this little offhanded exercise, match what you felt in relationship to that person who you said earlier, if they just change everything, your life would be wonderful. Do you see a match there? Okay. Who's the common link in producing those feelings? Who's there every time it happens to you? No, couldn't be. Well, I have some good news and some bad news. There's only one problem in your life, and you're it. That's the bad news. Fortunately, there's a solution. The solution lies within you as well. And as you recognize that you're the one that's there every time it happens to you, I mean, think back in your life. Yesterday, last week, last month, last year, 10 years ago, if you experienced any of these feelings, whose thought had to be resonating, had to be firing in you to feel those feelings? They had to be yours. Now, if tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, or 10 years from now, whose thought has to be resonating in your energy field for you to feel those stresses? Has to be your own. How many expect to experience emotional turmoil like that at some point in the future? Why would you do that to yourself? I would offer there's only one reason. You're insane. We have been taught in insane thought structures in our culture. We've been taught to live in those insane thoughts. And we have those thoughts stored within our structure, and not understanding that those thoughts are stored within our structure, we produce stresses within us right down to and including the cellular level as a result of the thoughts we think. If you go into the opening words in the book of John in the New Testament, and we're going to look not at the English translations that we usually see. We're not going to look at Greek sources, which are far, far removed from the original Aramaic. We're going to actually go back to the native language that those teachings came from. And what you find is in that Aramaic language, and the Aramaic language is the root language of five of the world's major religions. And what you find in that language is practical, here's how life works teachings, not theological, religious dogma. You find tools for living life. And if you go to the opening words in the book of John, we're generally told that the opening words say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. Well, actually, in the Aramaic language, what it says is, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. Your mind energy becomes your flesh. And if you put mind energy into your system that doesn't belong in your system, you are going to experience the effects of a negative stressor. If you deny responsibility and don't see that you're the one that was there every time it happened to you, then you will think that that stressor is someone else in your life. But you'll notice, once again, if you've been through that particular stressor 87 different times with 42 different people, you are the one that was there every time. You are involved in your life. And what shows up in your mind tells you more about what's in your mind than it tells you about what somebody else outside of you is doing. And so if you look at those feelings come from your thoughts, and your feelings are molecular. Your thoughts are molecular. Your stressors are molecular. There's a woman named Candace Pert, who is the former head of the Brain Bio Research Unit at the National Institute of Health. And here's what Candace Pert says. And you'd almost think that she was peeking at the book of John when you hear this. Here's a medical researcher at a laboratory that says every thought we think produces a molecule in the body. And the quality of the molecule matches the quality of the thought. Your thoughts produce molecules in your structure. And then if you go to the cell biologist laboratory, the cell biologist will tell us that those molecules, which are called neuropeptides, travel throughout the system. And where the cell
has a receptor site for those neuropeptides. The neuropeptide, that molecule that is produced by your thought, lands on that receptor site. And once it lands on the receptor site, once the cell picks it up, the cell replicates that energy structure within itself. And what you find is that every thought you think produces a result within your structure, and the results that you feel the effects of are the results that you've allowed yourself to think. And the molecules that end up floating around in your structure, landing on the cell and producing cellular stress, always come from you. They can't come from anybody else. And as you take responsibility for that, in fact, if you go to the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount, we're told there's a Beatitude that says, "Blessed are they who mourn their wrongs, for they shall be comforted." Now, I don't know, has anybody here ever gotten really excited about mourning your wrongs and felt really comforted as a result of it? It's a bit of a stretch for me. But if you go to the Aramaic language, what it says, first of all, the word "blessed are they" isn't there in the Aramaic language. There's no word that resembles that in Aramaic. What the word in Aramaic is in that beatitude is tuvehun, and tuvehun is a three-part word. And basically what it says is this, is that a latent or an unconscious neural structure implanted by God to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession, you who, and then where it says, we're told it says comforted out of the Greek translations. It says, you who look into your errors in thought. And then it doesn't say you're going to be comforted. What it says in Aramaic is, you will be cured of mental stress. When you start to look into where your mind goes that produces the molecular structure that ultimately becomes your genetic structure and is passed on to the next generation, if you want to change that process, you've got to take responsibility for every thought you think, which means every molecule you put in your structure, which becomes literally a part of your cellular structure. 2,000 years ago, this man named Jesus, who was not a religious teacher, he was teaching how life worked, said, hey, you want to clean up your act? You want to clean up the stresses that are going on within your structure? Here's a key. Look into your errors in thought and clean them up. And when you do, you will be cured of mental stress. It's up to you to decide what you do with that. You can't count on somebody else in the world to support you in doing that. You're going to have to make the choice as to how you run your mind and how you run your life. It isn't up to somebody else. But oftentimes, because we don't understand how our stresses are created, it appears that it's run by somebody else. So what I'm going to invite you to do now is I'm going to invite you to pick a partner. If you're at home and you don't have someone there listening to this tape with you, I'll invite you to get a mirror out, and that will be your partner. And so I'm going to ask each in the audience, if you would, to pick a partner. And sit face-to-face with your partner, if you would. Now, if one person in each partnership would say, I'll be light, just to identify yourself so you've got a name, and one person in each partnership would say, I'll be peace. So we've got light and peace. We've got two partners. And I'm going to ask you to do an exercise of sending and receiving. You're going to get to send in doing this exercise, and you're going to get to receive. So I'm going to give instructions for both sides. What are you going to do when you're the sender? Then what are you going to do when you're the receiver? And then I'm going to ask one of you, and we'll give you instructions then as which one will start. When you're the sender, I'm going to ask you to get quiet, go inside, and find the deepest, quietest, most powerful love that you can. Eyes closed, shut down the visual stimulus. Find the deepest, clearest love that you can. Intensify that. Don't start yet because I've got to give the receiving instructions too. So intensify that love. And as you intensify it and can feel it flood your structure, then I'm going to ask you to open your eyes and send it out through your eyes to your partner. Okay? So that's what you're going to do when you're sending. Now, the receiver, we're going to ask you to, of course, keep your eyes open while your partner gets ready and prepared to send. And when they send, we're going to ask you to check out what, if anything, they're sending. So imagine that your partner is squirting water out through their eyes. And so you're going to check out the temperature of the water. So I'm going to ask you to take the palm of your hand, place your awareness there, and pass it across in front of their eyes between you. So it's going to pass, right, between you and the person who's sending. And be aware and feel what you feel on the palm of your hand. And then, so that you have a second reference point, you've checked it out with the palm of your hand, we're going to ask you to do exactly the same physical action, passing your hand between yourself and the person who's sending, only this time we're going to ask you to put your awareness on your face, just so you've got a second reference point to check out how what they're sending feels to you. Are there any questions about the sending and receiving, about what to do when you're the sender, what to do when you're the receiver? Anyone have a question? No? Clear? Question, okay. When you're the sender.
Yeah, when you're the sender. And then you open your eyes to the sender.
You open your eyes and then direct the energy out through your eyes to your partner. Yes. Okay. Question.
Their eyes or just to them?
Just to them. To them. You're going to be looking eye to eye, so you're going to send it to the just to their face, what have you. Yeah. Okay. Great. And the receiver is going to pass the hand and check out what, if anything, they're sending. Okay? We're going to ask you to just have a second reference point. So you've got reference point one, the surface of your hand. So you're passing it between the person who's sending, and just see, again, imagine they're squirting water on there. What temperature is this water? And then, so you have a second reference point, let the energy come to your face, and just shift your awareness from your hand to your face. Do the same physical action, pass it between you, and see if you notice anything different on your face. Just shifting your awareness from one place to the other. Okay? So light, would you send first? Okay, so light, if you'd be the sender. And as soon as you're complete, just reverse roles. Peace, you become the sender. Light, you become the receiver. If you're at home watching this video, do it in the mirror with yourself. See what you experience. Of course, preferably there's a partner there you can work with. Okay, did anybody notice anything? What happened? And if you would just speak loudly enough, we've got a microphone here. You might even move up toward the microphone and share what you experienced.
When I was receiving, I didn't feel anything until he, I don't know what was it, and then there was this line of heat.
Okay, so you found a shift as soon as he smiled. That's when you started to feel, and it felt like just a line, like a band of heat. Okay, great. Anybody else experience it differently? You could feel the warmth on your hand. Okay?
Joy.
So you went into an emotional response. So you felt joy. Okay. Not on purpose. It was just there. Great. Okay.
I just felt kind of more like there was more pressure.
So you could experience it on your hand as a pressure. Okay. All right. Anyone else experience it differently? So you could feel an energy of some kind on your hand as well as warmth. Okay? Warmth and tingling sensation. Okay. Now, let's look another level. Is there anybody who's noticing a difference in your stress level right now from 5 minutes ago when you were focusing on those other feelings? It seems like the smiles are much larger at this moment than they were a few minutes ago. So you're noticing a difference. What do you notice? Okay. You found it relaxing, felt good. Okay. Anyone else?
It was kind of a happy, exciting feeling.
Okay, so you went from happy and to happy and exciting. Okay. Did anyone have any fatigue a few minutes ago whose fatigue level has changed?
Right. Yes.
Yes? Most every head shaking, yes? Okay. Go ahead. What did you experience? Okay, so your whole arm was able to feel the sensation.
Yes. I bit my whole body, but it should, you know.
So you could feel it all over,
yes.
Physically. Okay. Your face definitely looks different than it did 5 minutes ago.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank
good.
I feel different.
Yes. Okay. Great. Anyone else?
When I went in as a receiver, the instructions you gave were to find that place of, you know, intense love.
Right.
But I noticed when I first went down, I ran into some obstacles.
So you had obstacles to go through to get to that feeling of love.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before I could really, you know, be with that, I had to kind of move them out of the way.
Okay. Great. Good catch.
It's a nice experience.
Good. Wonderful. So you have an assignment now. And your assignment is to do this exercise twice a day for the rest of eternity. And that's with another person. And then to do it with yourself twice a day in the mirror. And if you have any body image problems, do it with yourself twice a day in the mirror in the nude. And watch how things start to shift and change. Notice the difference in your stress level. This is the master stress reliever. Notice the difference in the way that you feel. Now, if you go back 2,000 years ago, they asked, you know, what's the most important thing in this thing called the law? And what the master said was, there's a condition of mind that you've got to create in order to be sane. Of course, I'm paraphrasing at this point. But there's a condition of mind that you've got to create before you do behavior. And when you start to see that condition of mind is the key to intelligence, and you see how the mind operates in that regard, it is mind-boggling. It is amazing. And so we want to look a little bit at how stress is created. What did you do to create the stresses you just experienced? And notice that you had a stress that went in the direction of behavior. You'll find that the end result of stress, generally speaking, is some form of behavior. Or non-behavior, which is also a form of behavior. There's a psychiatrist who used to work with people who were catatonic. And his specialty was getting the catatonic out of that catatonic state. And of course, the catatonic's a person who just sits and they're so stressed out they don't respond to anything. They're gone. And this fellow says that he never, in the technique that he used, he never had to get above the knee in order to take these people out of their catatonic state. And so here's what he'd do. He's working with people who are hospitalized. Maybe you're aware of what a hospital gown is like to be in. And here you are sitting in a chair in a hospital gown. And what this fellow would do is he'd sit in front of the catatonic and tell them, I know exactly what's happening for you, and I'm going to help you to get out of this catatonic state. And he would reach down and he'd pull a hair out of their ankle. And then he'd move up about an inch, and then another inch, and another inch. Said he never had to get above the knee. Now, what he did, perhaps knowingly or unknowingly, when you start to look at stress and how stress creates behavior, what he did was that he took advantage of an unconscious goal that people have. And in triggering that goal, and again, you don't have to let your imagination wander too far to recognize what that goal is if you're sitting in a chair, catatonic, in a hospital gown with somebody pulling hairs out of your leg working up to your knee. You know, it's a pretty deep level goal there for most people. And we're going to see that goals are the key to stress. That when you set a goal in your mind, that goal creates stress. And that goal creates behavior. And we're going to look at how the process of goal setting works and how the mind operates and why it was so brilliant of this man named Jesus 2,000 years ago that said that the first requirement of the law was to hold a space of love when you think of God, of neighbor, and of self. Basically, what he was pointing out is the three major objects of attention for a human being. And what he was saying was that if you're going to set a goal in regard to any of those objects of attention, if you're going to go into any form of behavior, you better have the condition of love in your mind. And it's interesting to note that in the Aramaic language, there are 17 different words that have been translated with one English word, love. Now, if he knew what he was talking about, it would seem like it might be important and useful to know which word he used and what that word meant. Well, in the Aramaic language, the word he used was the word rachma. There is no similar word or concept or idea in the Greek language nor in the English language. There isn't a word for it. But that condition is, that word rachma is a condition in the mind. It is a condition of holding literally a filter in our minds over intentions. And when you start to see the chain of action in the mind when a stress happens, all of a sudden it just shines a light of brilliance on this man saying that the first law was hold rachma, hold a condition of love in your mind. And so I'm going to draw a diagram, and this is a human head pointed in that direction, just in case you don't recognize it. And what we'll find is that in the frontal lobes of the brain, all of our intentions are stored. So we have this pool of intentions. And in the back of the brain, we have another pool. We have a pool of perceptions. So we have these two pools in the mind. Over each pool, there is a filter. Actually, there are three filters, three sets of filters. Over intentions, there is a fear filter. There is an hostility filter. And there's a filter that in Aramaic was called rachma. It's been translated as love. But more specifically, is a filter over intentions. And then what we'll find is that there are also three filters, and this is being verified at Tulane University, bone implant EEGs. They're finding with these bone implant EEGs three signatures coming from the brain, one that they've come to identify as hostility, one that they've come to identify as fear, and one that they've come to identify as love. They're documenting it medically. And so we have over this pool of perceptions a fear filter, an hostility filter, and another filter that in Aramaic was called kuba, which has also been translated. It's one, another one of the 17 words that's been translated as love. You say, well, okay, that's interesting, but so what? Well, what you'll find is that your intentions are the raw material of your goals. Intentions are the raw material of goals. And so the quality of your intentions determines the quality of your goals. And there are three qualities of intentions that can come out of this pool according to the filter that is set. If one filter is active, the output of the other two is blocked. So whichever filter is operative in your mind will determine the quality of your intentions, your available intentions. And so if we have the fear filter active over intentions, what we'll find is that our intentions will be of a particular quality, and that is they will be negative. If the hostility filter is the active filter, then our intentions are going to be of a destructive quality. And if our rachma filter is active, our intentions are going to be of a loving quality. Why would that be important? Because it is your intentions that ultimately lead to and drive behavior. Your intentions when converted to a goal. Let's look at how an intention can be converted to a goal and drive behavior. I'm going to ask you to cooperate with me if you would, and I'm going to ask you to imagine that out in front of you, about 3 feet in front of your face, there's a red sponge ball. Okay? And I'm going to ask you to reach your hand up and reach for that ball. And at about the halfway point in doing so, I'm going to ask you to change and decide, without changing the intention or the goal to reach for the ball, decide to pull your hand back away from it. Okay, so holding the intention, I'm going to go for the ball, and then about halfway there, I'm going to pull my hand back. And just see what happens. Give that a try. What do you notice happening in your arm?
You can't do it unless you change your intention.
Okay. You can't do it unless you change your intention. Okay. What else? Anybody notice anything about your arm?
Tension.
Tension. It's tight. It locks up. You look at people in our culture, and you look at how their bodies are tense, some people almost like rocks. And what you find is you've got conflicting goals happening. And when there are conflicting goals, conflicting chemistry takes place, conflicting behavior. Reaching your arm out to grab the ball is a behavior. Letting that behavior continue while changing and pulling away from it creates a conflicting chemistry in your structure. Your mind energy changes your chemistry. Is there anybody here that knows how to reach out and grab that ball? Is there anybody here that knows how to do that? Okay, you sure? All right, we have a man who says, I know how. Would you please explain to me? First of all, I want to know which brain cells have to fire in what part of the brain, and then which nerve pathways they follow to which muscles, and what exactly are the balances and counterbalances to raise your arm and reach out to grab the ball and close your fingers around it. Could you explain that process to us? Not likely, right? I mean, the truth is we don't have a clue how to do it. We do it, but we don't know how. Something in us knows how. Something in us follows instructions. Very important. You remember this guy 2,000 years ago said, of myself I do nothing. The Father within me does the work. We don't have a clue how to do this stuff. If it was left to us, it would never happen. But you set an instruction in place, and you've got the cooperation of the creative power of the universe within you, working in you and through you. And if you give it conflicting instructions, you're in trouble. And if you give it destructive or negative instructions, you're going to have a problem. And so the quality of intentions, we have this whole pool of intentions. The quality of those intentions determines ultimately the quality of our goals and therefore our behavior. Because as we trace this through and we go to the next step, what we're going to see is that our goals are the driver for the output of our mind, of our reality. And so to become aware of how this whole process operates, you see that the starting point is key. Now, why is it important what our pool of intentions is and which quality of intentions we bring forward? Well, our intentions are those things which are converted to goals. Goals drive behavior. I can remember when I was a kid being told this thing of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Like, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean you're not supposed to have good intentions? No, it doesn't mean that at all. What it does mean is that you can have all the good intentions in the world, but if you don't convert them to goals, they will never impact your behavior. So we take an intention and we convert that intention to a goal. Now, today most people are somewhat familiar with computers. And let's take a look at the computer as a model for what's happening with these goals. The computer operates based upon the drivers that are loaded in the computer. For instance, if you want to see a picture on your screen, you have to have a driver for your screen. If you change to a different monitor, you're going to have to load a different driver. If you've got an IBM Pro printer hooked up to your computer, you need to have a driver in your computer that knows how to communicate with that printer in order for any output to happen. There has to be a driver. If I change from an IBM Pro printer to an NEC SilentWriter, I have to load a new driver in order to communicate with that NEC SilentWriter. Well, in precisely the same fashion, you have to have a driver for behavior. You have to have a driver for the realities that your mind outputs. And the driver is the goal that you hold. The quality of the goal is of key importance. You can't get a high-quality goal out of a low-quality intention. So the pool of intentions are of utmost importance to how you're going to behave in your life. Now you go back and you hear this man 2,000 years ago that says, first order of business for a human being, if you think of God, if you think of neighbor, if you think of self, the first order of business is you've got to hold this condition in your mind. Now let's do a practicum on goals driving behavior and how that happens. Once you set a goal, the quality of the goal determines the quality of the filter that filters your perception. There's some Harvard statistics that tell us that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is, there are 10,000 units, measurable units of electrical activity, that in that same time frame, the reality that we experience, the output of our minds, that which drives our behavior, is made up of a maximum of 9 bits of information. Very small, select bit of information actually shows up in your reality. And the information is selected and organized according to the stresses created by your goals. If you don't ever elevate an intention to a goal, you won't have a stress that will move your behavior. And basically what we'll find is stress, to define it, is this. Stress is a difference between the way we want it to be and the way we perceive it to be. Or the way it is. The difference between the way we want it to be and the way it is. And sometimes the way it is just the way we perceive it. They're not necessarily the same. So let's use the example I used earlier of the tack. If I sit on a tack, I experience a stress. I want comfort in a certain part of my anatomy. And the way I want it to be is not the way it is. And so I go into action. In order to do what? Alleviate the stress. And so my behavior becomes the mechanism that balances what I want and what I see. So I have a goal, it's what I want, and I have a way that I see what's happening in the world, and that's what I see, or that's the way it is. And if there's a difference, the degree of difference will be the degree of motivation I have to act. So let's take that now into a practical example. Let's imagine that you had heard about this workshop happening tonight, and you decided that you might want to come to it, and you wanted to bring some friends. And let's imagine that you've got one friend on each, that lives on each side of you. You know, their driveway's 50 yards down the road from yours on each side. And you meet those two friends, you say, hey, you know, tomorrow night there's this workshop called Getting the Stress You Need. I'd really like to go and see it. Would you like to come with me? And one of the neighbors says, well, you know, actually, I was thinking about going to the movies tomorrow night, so I don't know whether I'll do that or not, but you know, it sounds like a good idea. It sounds like an interesting topic. I'll think about that. I think I might go. And by the way, if I don't go, you know, there's a really good movie playing. How would you like to join me, and we'll go to a movie? And you say, well, you know, I was really wanting to go to that workshop, but, you know, I did want to see that movie, so let me think about that. And the third neighbor standing there, he says, well, gee, you know, I'd like to go to the workshop or to the movie. Okay, well, I'll think about it too. So you now have three people, each with two intentions, movies, workshop. Now, this afternoon rolls around, and you decide to pick one of those intentions. It's going to be either the movies, that's one intention, or the workshop. You decide to do one or the other. Now, obviously you're here, so you decided, you set the intention, you converted it to a goal, you set a goal to be here. So notice that the way you wanted it to be was to be at the workshop. Your reality was you weren't there. And so what did that goal bring forward from your perceptual memory and from your mind? It brought forward a reality that gave you a set of instructions as to how to get here for this workshop. That's the only way you got here. If you hadn't set the goal, you wouldn't be here because your mind would not have motivated you nor shown you how to get here. Now so there we have the workshop was elevated from an intention to a goal. And therefore, it became the reality that drove your behavior. Now, your next-door neighbor decided, I don't think I'm going to go to that workshop. I want to do the movie. And so a different intention
was converted or elevated to a goal. And his intention
that he converted was to a goal was to go to the movies. Now, his driveway was just 50 yards down the street from yours. He drove out the same driveway perhaps at the very same moment that you did. But he's not here. Why not? Because he had a different intention that he converted to a goal. And his mind organized the units of perceptual memory that he had much differently than yours. And his mind showed him how to get to the movie theater on time for the movie. That is, if his goal system allows him to be on time. Maybe he was late. Who knows? That last-minute dash to the movie syndrome. Okay? So he went to a totally different place. He got totally different instructions from his mind. His reality was completely different from yours. For one reason and one reason only. He had a different goal than you did. And the way he wanted it to be was at the movies, and he wasn't there. So what did his mind say? I know how to alleviate your stress. Here's how we get to the movies. We come out the driveway and we drive in the other direction. We don't drive in the direction of the workshop like the neighbor did. And he's sitting watching a movie right now because his behavior reduced his stress. It fulfilled the way he wanted it to be. And so when you start to see that whole mechanism operating, then you see that for a human being to do any behavior, if you think about the Creator, if you think about God, and there is any behavior to be done, where would you want to start? Where is your highest and best reality going to come from? Is it going to come from a mind that's in fear? Not likely. If you go back and you listen to this man 2,000 years ago, he spoke about fear as a demon to be cast out. He knew exactly how this mind operated. He knew far more about how the mind operates than we even start to comprehend today. And he treated this as a demon to be cast out. You remember? Perfect love casts out fear. You know what perfect love is in the Aramaic language? Perfect love is rachma and kubah set in the mind. And what he was essentially saying is, if you want to eradicate fear from your life, you've got to set those two filters, and you've got to be responsible for keeping them set. Now, you might have a pool that has different intentions and different perceptions in them. And someone comes along and triggers those intentions and those perceptions, and you find yourself with rachma and kubah gone from your mind and being in hostility or fear. And if so, then the behavior-driving realities that come forward, you have a reality formation system within your mind, and the behavior-driving realities that come forward will be based on what goals are resonated in your mind. And if that person can resonate in you fear, the intention from fear will be negative. The reality that comes forward from a fearful intention will be constructed in a way that shows you what is threatening. About the object of intention, God, neighbor, or self. So you have in you, in your pool of perceptions, brain cells that hold information about threat. And if that's the active filter over intentions and perceptions, then your mind will structure a reality that shows you something threatening about God, about neighbor, about self. If the hostility filter is the one that's set, you'll get a totally different quality of reality. The reality that will come forward from the hostility filter will always show you what is irritating. About the object of attention. If Rachman and Kubah are set, your mind will always show you something loving about your object of attention. Now, again, let's take that into a practical realm. Let's imagine you have this person in your life that is the love of your life. I love you, I honor you, I cherish you, I will love you forever. Now, your mind is showing you in your reality lots of things that you love about them. But what happens when they give you the look? You got anybody in your life that knows how to give you the look? What does that look do? Does it resonate a different filter in you? If it resonates fear in you, and you are not in charge of your own mind, and you don't understand the first law of governing in the mind, then what's going to happen is your goals toward them will be based upon negative intentions. And in setting those negative goals, what your mind is going to show you is something threatening about them. Now, how many have had it happen? They give you the look and all of a sudden it's, don't touch me, don't come near me, I never want to see you again. Like, wait a minute, how is this possible? A moment ago this was the love of your life, how do you convert to, how do you switch to? They're the same person, you're the same person, what changed? The only thing that changed was the active filter in your mind. And now you have a pool of intentions that show you threat, and your mind builds your image, your picture of them, your reality about them out of that pool of perceptual memory. And they show up in your mind as threatening. Whose job is it to do something about that? Yours or theirs? Whose thoughts produce the chemistry, the stresses in your mind? I would offer it's only you. You're the one that's liable for how this whole process operates. If that person resonates in you the hostility filter with the look, then what will happen is you will all of a sudden be irritated. Now let's look at that one in a practical sense. How many have heard the story? You know, we've all heard stories about the, you know, little 5'2" woman who had this 6'9" gorilla of a husband who always beat up on her and abused her. And so every time she looked at him with the fear filter active, what did she feel? What did she experience as the reality in her mind? She saw, her mind selected evidence that showed her what was threatening about him. But we've all heard it said that one day something cracked in her mind, right? Well, you know what cracked? She shifted from fear to hostility. Now, when you shift filters, when you move out of fear, your mind will no longer produce a threatening reality. And the minute that hostility flipped in and she went to destructive intentions and therefore her mind showed her what was irritating, she went to a different pool of perceptions. And stored there was all the information she held about being in irritation. And now she is really peeved. And you don't want to get in her way, do you? And neither does he, even though he's 6'9", because he's in trouble. And the only difference is that she flipped from one filter to another. What the Master was telling us 2,000 years ago is that if you always want the highest and best output from your mind, you keep perfect love active in your mind. Fear is not possible. Hostility is not possible. What you will find is the store of intentions and the store of perceptions will always show you what is loving about the object of your attention.
Well, does that mean that I just have to lay down and I've got this neighbor that's, you know, you're talking about neighbor here, I've got this neighbor that's going to attack me, I just lay down and let him attack? No, it doesn't mean you passively accept abuse. But what you do, especially if you've got a neighbor that's about abuse, is you want to have the most intelligent, the highest capacity mind possible to see what can be done in that circumstance. Which mind is that? I would offer it's going to be the mind of love. That's going to give you the best evidence possible. If you've ever been in a courtroom and you've watched the opposing attorney go after the defense witness, what's the first thing they do? They get them either into hostility or fear. Why? Because at that moment they're stupid. They make mistakes.
And so recognize that. The Greeks had this saying that whom the gods would destroy, they first make angry. Why? Because we'll destroy ourselves if we're in anger. This produces chemicals that are stressors in our cellular structure. The neuropeptides that land in the cell, that generate the chemistry inside the cell, is up to us. First law, keep the condition of love in your mind. And let's take an intermission.